Welcome to Real Estate Radio Live, an informative and engaging podcast discussing everything you need to know about the world of real estate. Your host, Joe Cacera, provides you with insight and guidance on how to buy, sell, finance, and invest in real estate. He also offers real estate tax management strategies, new construction advice, home improvement tips, and much, much more. And now, to guide you around the world of real estate, here's your host and Real Estate Radio Live team leader, Joe Cacera.
Welcome in, Joe Cacera with Real Estate Radio Live. Thank you for those that are following us on Facebook. We appreciate the continued support. We want to continue to grow the show as much as we can, and we want to just thank you for the continue to follow the show, those that download the show. We're continuing to grow on a regular basis, and that's good. I hope we're doing something well. The focus has always been education and information, almost 8 years now, live radio and podcast. And we've also introduced a couple of new topics over the last couple of years. Those that are following the show, you know that Jack Russo has joined us. And the first year we did starting something new in Silicon Valley, really just A to Z, starting and building a business. And then now we're series is on growing your business, and there's different aspects of that. So we're going to continue that today in just a second. For more information, you can always go to reradiolive.com. That's reradiolive.com. We have Jack on the line, and I'll then bring Jack in first, and he'll tell us where not only where he's calling from, and then he'll introduce our guest that's joining us today as well. Welcome in, Jack.
Yeah, thank you. I'm calling in from the European Union. I've been at a conference here in Austria, so it's 9 hours ahead. It's midnight here. I'm in a very quiet library in a very quiet place using very significant technology that we use for the show, which is the Zoom system. I just use the audio so that the audio would be at the highest level because the video would just show my lovely tired face after some jet lag here. So, and I'm so happy that we have a great guest on because we're at the third essence. We've covered team in a couple of shows. We've covered technology in a couple of shows. We're going to start this show by talking about financing. It's a big topic. I'm sure we'll end up doing at least another show, maybe more. And eventually we'll get through all seven essences of growth that include things that are very important, like customer demand and how scaling occurs and that what happens as competitors enter and what barriers to entry can be maintained and so on. And we'll get through all seven essences. And we have on the line Russ Irwin, who was, and still I think to some degree does, although he may tell me that he's too rich and now he's totally retired, busy flying his jet plane around or something like that. He just got his pilot's license, I think. But welcome, Russ. Russ was the managing partner of Convergence, which is a very early stage and very successful venture capital firm. But I've known Russ now for years, decades, I think, and I know him very well. So, Russ, can you hear me, hopefully, from where you are? Because you're probably sitting having a margarita with a great view of the bay there, right?
No margarita. It's not 5 o'clock yet in Sausalito.
Okay. You sound good. And Russ, we do this show with the view of trying to explain to folks listening, both entrepreneurs as well as a host of investors, that there really are elements to both starting as well as growing. We covered starting last year in a series that was at least a couple of times a month. Now we're covering growing, and we're at this third essence. And sometimes I order the essences in a way that suggests that maybe getting customers first is more important than going out for financing. I think there's a certain duality to it where it's a horse race where you're trying to gain customers on the one hand, and you're also trying to get financing that will help you put more feet on the street to getting those customers to happen, because you should have at this point a team that's executing on a technology that's produced a product that sort of is resulting in some revenue and some activities, although you might still be pre-revenue and certainly you're going to be pre-profit. But before we get to all that, maybe you should tell folks who are watching and listening in and a little bit about yourself and how you made your journey to become who you are and the venture capital role that you played, because my recollection is you actually started or maybe made your way through Apple as a person that was pretty senior at Apple Computer. So you had operating roles before you went out to venture capital, right?
Yeah, although Apple came in kind of later, probably 20 years into my career.
Yeah, didn't you like go take boats around the world first or do something really interesting before even taking a job?
No, actually, I started writing code for money at 17.
And, okay.
And I did that for, I worked my way through school writing code. And back when it wasn't as popular as it was today, but it paid a lot better than my alternatives when I was 17. Worked my way through school, worked for lots of different companies in the North Bay and San Francisco, did a lot of contract programming. It was still called programming back then. It wasn't called engineering. Then I decided to move to Lake Tahoe, actually. So I went up there and did a lot of skiing and a lot of hiking and more wrote more code and actually kind of started to move out of the writing code and into marketing and product management. And we had a startup that was headquartered in Houston and offices in Boulder, Lake Tahoe, San Jose, San Francisco. We kind of had this distributed organization, and that ran its life cycle. And through the course of that, I met some people in Silicon Valley because I'd bought some hardware from them. And at that point, I needed a job. I had a young son and a wife, and kind of no visible means of support. and I'd pretty much gotten as much skiing done as I wanted to do. I moved to Silicon Valley in 1986 from Tahoe.
Okay, so your path is actually similar in some ways to mine because I worked my way through college doing what was back then mainframe programming back in New York City, and then graduate school getting a master's degree in computer science doing that at City University in New York. And by a fluke of a combination of events, I ended up taking a bet with my roommate and betting that I would get a higher LSAT score than him, which I promptly did without taking the review course. He just loaned me his books. Mm-hmm. And then he convinced me, you have to go to law school. I mean, you got such a great score and you've done so well. And I was reluctant because I remember from the time of my folks, lawyers were people that sued people like middle class blue collar workers at a grocery store in New York, and people were always slipping and falling. And so I sort of argued with them, and then he took me to a professor who said, hey, you got to go just to get it in our book here at City University of New York that we send someone on to professional school. And that's how I made my way to UCLA and the West Coast and eventually to Silicon Valley. But you were doing programming, was it mainframe programs then or timeshare, or what was the actual coding back then?
Yeah, it was a little bit of everything. I mean, I was at Berkeley on and off, and I actually originally thought I would major in computer science, but then I at that point I was making pretty good money writing code, and I said, gee, you know, I get paid for doing this. I'm not going to just go do it for units. So it was mainframes and time sharing. I wrote kind of all kinds of stuff. I mean, at big companies and small companies. I mean, there was a system that was written entirely in 370 assembler, you know, mm-hmm. and there was stuff that was in COBOL or PL1 or Fortran or, you know,
right.
All the dead languages.
Yeah, it's interesting that a lot of the folks that we see now who get these demo products up and running with all this open source, they don't realize what we went through decades ago to get that code to work and debug. I mean, they get stuff done significantly faster and significantly lower costs, which is sort of one of the questions I have for you as when you became a VC eventually and started Convergence. You must have seen situations where people are like, we don't even need your money, because we see a lot of folks now that say we don't really need VC money per se. We've got a demo, and of course, they always think the product will sell itself and go a long way to try to explain it. That usually doesn't happen, even if it's a great product.
Yeah, that's really the essence of it. The product doesn't sell itself. And actually, rarely does the best product even win. So, I don't know. See, I mean, is there a question in there, Jack? Or is that...
Yeah, let me tell you what the question is. I see a lot of folks who say in the third essence horse race between getting financing or getting customers, one of them will be the fourth essence, and maybe they're both part of the third and fourth together. Which is more important? And more what I see, and I've seen over the last going on 40 years of doing this, is very much that the VCs want to wait for the customer referrals, and the customers are often asking, well, who are the VCs that are really making sure that you're going to be around? So it's really a chicken and egg problem. Do you see it differently, or how do you see it?
No, that's correct. I mean, VCs or any investor wants to minimize risk and maximize reward, right? So, you know, the further along the track they are, customers and product and distribution and everything else, then at the point that you invest, you know, your risk goes down. Your multiple might go down too, because you might be investing at a higher valuation if it's really like a, if you wait for a C or a D round or something. But the question of money or customers is, it's really not quite that simple. First of all, it depends on what it is you're building and what it is means to have customers. I mean, sometimes customers is just, you know, I have people who are interested in my idea if I can build the widget.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right.
That's fine. That's great. Then there's customers who are actually writing checks, you know, and then there's customers who have actually written checks and taken delivery. So, you know, I think the kind of what you're describing grew up around software, because software, as we both know, is extremely malleable. You can get up a skeleton these days really quick. You can get something where people go, oh, I see what you're talking about. Oh, I see what that'll do for me. And you can get pretty far along with, you know, three or four guys or people writing, you know, nights and weekends over the course of 4 or 5 months. You can do a lot. So on the other hand, if you're doing biotech, if you're doing, you know, gene product or medical devices, or silicon kind of is on the fence these days because you can do so much with modeling and simulation, but eventually you got to put it in silicon. And then how big or how ambitious are you being? I mean, if what you're doing is going to take 500 people, then you're going to need to get some money earlier. So I don't think it's really quite, you know, it's not a serial process like, oh, you should do this first or that first. And hopefully you're doing something that somebody hasn't exactly done before. So there isn't really a clear-cut answer always.
Right, right. But what's your reaction when you see these really kids? We see them all the time. They're sort of in the garage. Well, these days they might be in a bit of a time-shared WeWork incubator space, or maybe at a Y Combinator or some sort of incubator. And they say, look, we've got this great demo. It should really just wow customers, and we're just trying to sort of get to the next step and try to find someone who can actually be the sales officer, the revenue officer, someone that can get us into these accounts. And they want you to put money in, and they want you to put time in, and you're looking around saying this may take a lot more effort to sell than what they realize, because a lot of folks just think, oh, if I put it up and post a few ads on Google, all of a sudden it'll go viral, kind of like the way Facebook arguably did back in the day, you know, 15 plus years ago. How do you react to that when you're in the VC role?
Well, the first thing I tell people is that virtually everybody underestimates distribution.
Mm-hmm.
And especially engineers underestimate distribution. I mean, depending on the experience level of the engineers, early on, a lot of engineers have something bordering on distaste for anybody in sales. Like it's you know, they don't earn their money, and they're not, you know, what are they? They're not needed because my product is so brilliant that it sells itself.
Right.
People with more experience realize that's true, and ultimately, given the choice, I mean, a mediocre product with great distribution will completely destroy a great product with lousy distribution. So, so that's the first thing I tell people. Tell me about the distribution. And if it's a very engineering centric group of entrepreneurs, they're probably going to struggle with that question because they don't see the value in it. They don't kind of know and trust those, because the salespeople don't act like engineers. You know, they don't always show up at the meeting on time, and they're a little little different approach to work and to the customer and to the whole enterprise than the engineers do. So, you know, that's why, you know, you had a segment on teams, and that's why you want to look at a balanced team. You want to see is, you know, are there some people in the room who understand distribution, who understand marketing, who understand finance, in addition to engineering? And if there aren't, then you're looking at a really early stage deal with some people who are going to need to go find somebody to help them with distribution. So that's, I guess, how I would respond to your question and what I would respond to if a group of people came to me like that.
Right. And I take it that that group wouldn't do too well if they tried to convince you, hey, look, just give us $1 million and we'll buy some ads on Google and this thing will be off to the races. Right. I mean, it's rare that you can do that, although maybe Google wants folks to believe that you can do something like that.
It's there aren't really good examples of that, you know, around where you just take out an ad and then everybody just comes to your site and buys it and then you cash out for, you know, $500 million or something. It just doesn't usually work that way. So you're going to have to get distribution.
Right. So in many ways, you might say the team has to somehow find people who are taking the currency, often without salary, of stock or stock options, and who have at the head someone who really understands what the distribution model is going to be and perhaps has used their network already to get some reference accounts, whether you call that an alpha site or a beta site or something, to sort of prove up that the dogs are going to eat the dog food. And even though it smells good, it even tastes better, right? And folks
if a group of engineers comes to you, if you're an early stage investor or an angel, I mean, today a lot of early stage is done by angels, but a little further back, there were a lot of firms that specialize in early stage. And I've had situations where people came to us with, you know, they were really just the engineers. And you look at it and you go, okay, this has got a lot of potential. This actually really could do something if you can build this widget. Mm-hmm. So I'll give you a little bit of money. And, you know, and the first thing we're going to do is you're going to take some of that money and try to build the widget. And you're going to take some more money and we're going to get somebody in here who understands distribution. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe that's a seed round or whatever, and then you take it from there. And that person needs to go out, the distribution person needs to go out and talk to some customers. And I mean, it's the strength and the curse of the entrepreneuring engineer that they have absolute and total faith in their product. You don't want to discount that. It's just, it's necessary but insufficient. So, you want to add to that team. You want to add the people that balance it out, which is why if people come to you with a whole team, you know, you got a marketing person and a salesperson, for example, you know, and they understand the distinction between marketing and sales, you know, and maybe you've got a finance person, at least part-time, and you've got some engineers. Now you're kind of starting to look like a balanced unit, and you'll start to temper each other. You know, the sales and marketing guys will come back and say, well, this is really great, but, you know, half the customers are saying it kind of needs to be more like this. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you want to listen to that and sometimes you know, and that's probably the hardest thing that goes on in early stage companies is knowing whether you should bend the product to fit the feedback you're getting or whether the vision you have for the product is something that people just need to wrap their head around for a while longer before they really appreciate it. Hmm. And that's a tough problem. And that's a problem that pretty much every startup goes through.
Do you see that a lot, Russ? I mean, that's a good point. The difference between customer acceptance or maybe they're just not ready, or so the company has to make a decision. Do we stay the course with this widget the way it is, knowing that even though customers aren't quite getting it, they're going to need to get it because of A, B, and C, or do you adjust to the customer's needs? That's interesting. Yeah.
That is one of the toughest problems
in
every stage company.
Well, we've seen a lot of groups that come into our firm and they're just convinced that the product is perfect and the customer has to adapt. And I'm often saying exactly what you're saying, Russ, which is the first 10 customers are going to give you the most valuable mm-hmm. trade secret information that you can get out of that compilation. You better take advantage of that in some way that produces the next 10 and perhaps the next 10 and the next 10 beyond that. Because if you make that first 10 happy, each of those 10 may introduce you to 10 others, because people want you to succeed. I think one of the magics of Silicon Valley, and one of the themes we've been expressing in the series, is Silicon Valley unique? It can't be reproduced in all these different places around the United States, like Silicon Beach in LA and Silicon Slopes in Utah and so on. Or is there just a certain uniqueness that the folks want to help and the people are so motivated to try and they don't scare a failure that they'll just go out and do it and they'll make the adaptations and they'll make things happen. And of course they work ungodly hours and want to push the envelope as hard and as fast as possible. And you don't necessarily get that combination of people at the team level in other places. Is that what you see generally, or what have you seen in terms of, you've been in the Valley now for a while, how have you seen things change and where do you think it's going?
Well, the Valley's changed a lot. I mean, there were kind of a few questions floating around in there.
Right.
So, I mean, how the Valley's changing, I used to put everybody in the Valley kind of on a spectrum. And one end of the spectrum was people were just really excited about inventing the future.
Mm-hmm.
And at the other end of the spectrum, people just wanted to make money. Pure and simple.
Mm-hmm.
And early on, you know, it was much more to the invent the future. That was exciting to people. And I mean, I can remember talking to engineers 25 years ago, and they'd come to me and say, this is before it was a venture capitalist even, and they'd say, hey, you know, I got this offer at this startup, and they're going to give me 5,000 shares. You know, what do you think I should do? Should I do it? And then I introduced them to the denominator. I said, you know, 5,000 shares out of 50,000 or out of 5 billion?
Mm-hmm.
You know? And they'd look at me with that kind of, I used to call it the RCA dog look. You remember that logo?
Yeah.
Twist your head and look at you like, what are you talking about? And that ended. And pretty soon, engineers didn't talk about how many shares they were getting. They talked about what percentage they were getting.
Okay.
And that happened. And Silicon Valley gradually moved more and more towards the we're here to make money end of the spectrum, in my mind. You know, arguably to a fault in some areas. But what's really exciting about Silicon Valley is the idea, and I think what gets people to go to work in the morning, or still gets a lot of people to go to work in the morning, is the sense that I am inventing the future.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we used to, when I was at Apple, we actually ran this, we created this whole spoof video, which was, we ran at a big company meeting that talked about Cupertino being the center of the known universe.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And, in some ways, Silicon Valley is the center of innovation in the world, and it's not quite as much the center as everyone would like to think, but it still is, and that's still kind of what's most exciting. That was the thing that was most exciting about being a VC, and I think that's what's exciting for a lot of people is I'm making something new here, and there's, you know, a better than even chance that if I'm successful, this thing will spread throughout the world. And that's a motivator for people. And you still have plenty of people who are just there for the money.
Yeah.
I kind of went along that path, frankly. I mean, you know, as an engineer, you're just, hey, if your program runs, it's a good day, you know. And then eventually, you know, as you're a venture capitalist, it's like, well, what's your IRR? And,
yeah.
You know, that's strictly a measurement of how much money you're making. It's not a measurement of how much you change the world or anything else.
You're absolutely right, because the people that I see that I get most excited about, and I told this story today to a bunch of people here from the EU, are people that put the mission first, and they really want to see change. They see a lot of inefficiency. They see a lot of fat. They see a lot of stupidity. And I think back to the day when my old firm, then named Davis, Stafford, Kelman and Fenwick, now Fenwick and West, first saw Jobs and Wozniak, walked in the door. They weren't about money. They really did want to democratize computing, and they saw IBM in the big glass rooms that you and I worked in when we were doing mainframe programming with perhaps punch cards or very early Hazeltine terminals. Back in those days, you know, the computing was very centralized, and not having access to that big machine and having to fight over how much time did you get on it for your, you know, job running through the system and being debugged many, many times over, they saw that as it has to change. And I think when you see people with that kind of goal in mind, that burning desire, that big, big, hairy, audacious goal, and they don't even talk or care that much about the money. And I think they're more inclined to sort of say, of course, we're going to give stock and we're going to be diluted and we're going to get people to join the mission. We're on a crusade here, man. Join the crusade. You know, leave your boats behind, leave your nets behind and come to be fishers of men, kind of almost religious fervor. And I agree with you. Over the 40 years, I think a lot of that mission orientation has changed, and it is more about, well, give me the exact numbers and how much dilution will it be and what's my net after tax. And that's unfortunate because there's still a lot of big problems in the world with a lot of opportunity for solutions. I mean, right now, Joe is doing something I think is fabulous in trying to deal with all the fat in the real estate closing process. And up to now, I don't think, Joe, you're taking on a big, big set of incumbents here.
Right.
And in many ways, there's so much fat that there's a lot of people that can try to do a lot of things to make it challenging to deal with all that fat, because fundamentally it's later barriers to entry that we'll talk about later, and competition sort of go together the way you might say, you know, the team and the technology. The team's got to love the technology and really believe in it for the purpose of keeping the mission alive, because it is typically more like a 5 or 7 year hike. At least that's the way I look at it. It's typically not 3 years and you're going to flip the company and everyone's going to be a billionaire. That just rarely happens.
Yeah.
Well, that was part of the big shift. I mean, you know, literally it was Silicon Valley. You know, it was Silicon. It was, you had to make a widget. You had to make this thing. It had to come out of a foundry. And, you know, then the big shift was, you don't have to make a widget. You just have to make a new business model. And there's nothing wrong with that, obviously. I mean, that's really core to economic efficiency and productivity, is if we can change this model around, you know, we can drive out some fat, we can take a slice of it for ourselves and build a company. But the technology component of that is relatively light, right?
Russ, we got just a couple minutes left, and I want to interject here in terms of we have the listeners that are looking to, you know, they're growing, let's say they're growing their business already, they've got it going, or they're looking for second stage, you know, seed or A, or is it the profile of the combination of the team, the entrepreneur, and also the venture capital group that looks at things differently? There's probably no company the same. I guess my point is, if someone's listening to this and they think, okay, what's the magic bullet? What do I need? Do I need to walk in with the team, the concept, the product already established, or can I say, look at this widget, look what we're going to do, and can you help me build the team? Are those all those different facets? It depends on what you see and what the propensity is for the investment. Give us an idea, if the entrepreneur listens to this, kind of what they could expect if they're getting ready to pitch.
Yeah, so first and foremost, you need to be able to say in about 3 or 4 simple sentences what your company is going to do.
Got it.
And you can't believe how many presentations I sat through. And 20 minute presentation, I literally don't know what the company does. Now, and that was just, you know, horrible, right?
Yeah, it's a good point.
You know, and sometimes they can tell you what the company's going to do, and they kind of have that, they can express that. And then you ask this really simple question. Well, how are you going to make money doing that?
Right.
And again, you there's not a clear-cut answer.
Yeah.
You know, and so the best way to raise money is to walk in, know what you're doing, really be able to express it simply. If you can't put it into 3 or 4 sentences, which are obviously true to anyone who listens to them, then you're not ready yet. It's like when I was first in college, you know, and somebody said, write a 20-page paper, and you're like, oh, my God, well, how am I going to do that, right?
Right.
And then it became, you know, after you get good at writing, it becomes, somebody says, okay, I want a 2-page paper.
Yeah, right.
Like, oh, that's a lot harder. Well, that's what a VC pitch is. A VC pitch, you know, starts with the elevator pitch, and it goes on from there. You need to have that. You need to know what you're doing so clearly that you can get it out in 5 minutes and say, any questions?
Yeah.
Or even less than that, I would say that time is shrinking down to maybe you get a sentence or two, and it's got to resonate. So you've got to polish it in a way that you might say that a political campaign polishes the message, you know, make America great again, as much as it gets criticized, it really does resonate for probably half of the U.S. population. You know, those four words say a lot. And ultimately, I'm not a Trump supporter here, but I would say whoever he had that built those four words and got them on a red cap really did start a messaging that to this day he still is relying on. I look at a lot of Democratic candidates, not to go down this rat hole, but I see. Russ and I talk about this all the time because we say, gosh, the messaging of this, what is it now, 26 different candidates?
Yeah.
There's no message. There's nothing there that you can't, nothing resonates. You keep begging for someone's got to pick the ball up. And I think I say that often to people. You can pick a big brand or you can pick a great brand and hopefully it doesn't violate someone's trademark rights and the team can get it right. But you really have to have the byline. It's a little bit like a computer log group. You say, we help get the group, get the team and the technology out of the garage. Those words resonate. It's like, okay, there's a lot to that. But a lot of folks that are building a company and a brand, they don't necessarily get that you have to have that sentence or two. I'm not even sure you get three or four anymore, Russ. You're patient. You're probably more patient than most people.
The standard VC pitch, you kind of had a half hour. So, and the thing for the team to recognize is maybe even you get an hour, okay? But never plan to use more than half of that time.
Yeah, right? I tell you, Russ, no, it's very true. And Jack and I have been through this, and he's been a big help. And one of the things for an entrepreneur, I'll say we're going through it myself, one of the best things you could do is refine, meet with people, understand. Because over the period of time, it got to the point where, you know, they said, you got 4 minutes, and they had you on the clock. And that's and honestly, that's the best thing anybody could do because it really forces you to get granular quick and get your message out quick as you can and articulate it, the value proposition, without rumbling along.
That's number one for entrepreneurs. Yeah. Okay. Know what you're doing and be able to articulate it clearly and be able to explain how that will make money.
Well, Jack,
and right after that, we'll come, you know, somewhere in there, then we'll come distribution. Okay, that's great. How are you going to get this to people?
Right. Well, just a couple minutes to go, Jack. How you want to close us out and wrap us up here?
Well, I would say we're at the third essence, and we're talking about it as financing. But keep in mind that to pitch for the financing means you've captured even more of the essences in many ways. You're proving up, you're theorizing a form of customer demand that you better have some evidentiary support for. And I tell you, you know, people don't realize you can get that evidentiary support even by simple things like doing focus groups with people using the prototype. Because those focus groups will have different customer segments, and that feedback will tell you, yes, this will sell for this class of customer. It just won't sell to my mom who's 89 years old and doesn't really want to use YouTube and doesn't really understand how the internet works.
What you want to hear from those customers or those focus groups or whatever is not so much that they're going to buy it. I mean, you do want the willingness to buy it. Want to know that it's solving somebody's problem.
Okay.
You know, so what's the problem we're solving here and why is this going to solve it? Okay, now we can go find some people with that problem and we can, you know, vet this and do our diligence and whatnot. So what problem are you solving? A lot of times, you know, especially a group of engineers, they're not solving a problem. They just have a really whizzy technology.
No. That's a good point. I guess the other, on top of that, Russ, and not to get really to split hairs here, but is it, in some cases, is it a big enough problem? In other words, there are problems, but is the problem big enough to make money and have enough people accept it, et cetera, right?
Oh, yeah. No, that's absolutely correct. I mean, you know, the rule of thumb used to be, well, if, you know, if it's got to be able to be at least a $1 billion business. Obviously, it's kind of moved on a bit from that. But, if you're solving a problem that it turns out that 10,000 people have, unless those people are willing to spend an awful lot of money, that's great. I'm glad you have a solution and have a great day. You know, but you're not going to go raise a few hundred million dollars.
All right, Jack.
I'm still here. I got bounced off because
Zoom technology
failed us here for a minute. But it can't. I have to give it credit. It comes up back on automatically without pressing any buttons. So kudos to the folks at Zoom. Yeah. And I was never a big believer in this video conferencing stuff. And I used to say, just give me a plain old telephone type line, an ordinary POTS line. And we still have a few of them at our office. But I'm becoming more and more convinced that breaking time zones and allowing people to work anywhere around the world and still get together for these types of calls and video calls, and then being able to record it and turn it into a podcast. It's just an amazing technology at an exceptionally low cost. So they've kind of cracked the code here, and I give them a lot of credit. And I'm sure it took a lot of work to get to where they're at as a company. But in general, Russ, thanks for spending your time with us. I'm sure we'll have you back as we go through the rest of these essences with the view of coming up with the magic statement of how should teams with their technology get their financing and prove out that they can repeat the customer journey that they will have started just as they get further development of the product along. And then we're going to hit this whole question about scaling and protecting and then dealing with the direct competition that may play out from some really big players like Facebook and Apple and a host of others that are out there with great brands and obviously huge financial positions. So thanks for coming, Russ. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, sure. You're welcome. And thank you, Joe. And best of luck with your, I understand you're working on a venture, Joe. And
I'd love to.
The industry is certainly ripe for improvement.
It is. I'd love to hear your feedback or get your feedback on it as well. Russ, are you officially retired? I don't want to give information out. Are you still doing some venture stuff, or are you pretty much retired and enjoying the good life now?
No, I literally sailed away 11 years ago.
but you
sailed away. I came back 5 years later, but...
But you traded in your yacht for some super jet that I'm waiting to get on once you get the 5G internet to work.
But I love looking at business models and business plans. So I'm happy to sit down with you sometime if you like.
Yeah, I'd love to
do
that.
Yeah, let's plan that over a beer because Russ is just so capable of seeing immediately where the gaps are.
All right.
Coming up with brilliant ideas. I mean, that's what you get from both being an entrepreneur himself, as well as part of startup teams, as well as part of a venture capital firm. So it's a huge, huge plus factor to have someone be able to do all those things and do them so well. So thanks, Russ.
Yes.
I guess you should mention you're not taking any calls and you're not getting any emails, but I am. So I'm still very much active as, Computer Law Group, Jack Russo, managing partner, 650-327-9800. Although these days people only use email or mostly use email. Of course, Europeans still want your phone number. They want to talk to you. But it's pretty much an email-centric world, particularly in Silicon Valley. So it's jrusso@computerlaw.com. And thanks for allowing me to do this in the times I'm in here. I appreciate both Russ and you, Joe, putting up with the connectivity issues.
No, it's great.
Internet is not perfect here, but it's probably better than most other countries in the EU.
Well, it's not perfect, but I'll tell you what, considering across the country and linking some people together, I think the audio is pretty good, and we're going to get a good message across. So, yeah, thanks, Jack. Enjoy the rest of your trip. And, Russ,
thanks
again for your time. It was very valuable. We appreciate it very much.
Good. Great. Look forward to seeing you guys next week. Talk to you later.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
This is Joe Cachera with Real Estate Radio Live. Thanks again for tuning in. Great, great show. Again, this is the series of Growing Your Business with Jack Russo. For more information, you can go to reradiolive.com. That's reradiolive.com. Take care. Have a great afternoon.
You've been listening to Real Estate Radio Live. For more information on today's program, visit reradiolive.com. That's reradiolive.com. Subscribe to our podcast. Discover more at reradiolive.com.